the floor of the car. 17th Precinct Headquarters, East 51st Street, Manhattan. The old professor sat at the very end of the bench inside lockup, as far away as possible from a shirtless, snoring man who had just relieved himself without wishing to trouble anyone else for directions to the toilet in the corner of the room, or even removing his pants. Satrakeen? Satarkian? Satraniak? Here, he answered, rising and walking toward the remedial reader in the police officer's uniform by the open tank door. The officer let him out and closed the door behind him. Am I being released? Asked Satrakian. I guess so. Your son's here to pick you up. Satrakian held his tongue. He followed the officer to an unmarked interrogation room. The cop pulled open the door and motioned for him to walk inside. It took Satrakian a few moments, just long enough for the door to close behind him, to recognize the person on the other side of the bare table as Dr. Ephraim Goodweather of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Next to him was the female doctor who had been with him before. Satrakian smiled appreciatively at their ruse, though he was not surprised by their presence. Satrakian said, "So, it has begun." Dark circles, like bruises of fatigue and sleeplessness, hung under Dr. Goodweather's eyes as he looked the old man up and down. You want out of here? We can get you out. First, I need an explanation. I need information. I can answer many of your questions, but we have lost so much time already. We must begin now, this moment, if we have any chance at all of containing this insidious thing. That's what I'm talking about, said Dr. Goodweather, thrusting out one hand rather harshly. What is this insidious thing? The passengers from the plane, said Satrakian. The dead have risen. Eve did not know how to answer that. He couldn't say. He wouldn't say. There is much you will need to let go of, Dr. Goodweather, said Satrakian. I understand that you believe you are taking a risk in trusting the word of an old stranger, but in a sense, I am taking a thousandfold greater risk in trusting this responsibility to you. What we are discussing here is nothing less than the fate of the human race, though I don't expect you to quite believe that yet, or understand it. You think that you are drafting me into your cause. The truth of the matter is, I am drafting you into mine. The Old Professor. Knickerbocker Loans and Curios, 118th Street, Spanish Harlem. Eef put up his emergency blood delivery windshield placard and parked in a marked loading zone on East 119th Street, following Satrakian and Nora one block south to his corner pawn shop. The doors were gated, the windows shuttered with locked metal plates. Despite the tilted closed sign jammed in the door glass over the store hours, a man in a tattered black peacoat and a high-knit hat, like the kind Rastafarians liked to wear, except that he lacked the ropey dreadlocks to fill it out, so it sagged off his head like a collapsed souffle, stood at the door with a shoebox in his hand, shifting his weight from foot to foot. Satrakian came out with keys dangling from a chain, busying himself with the locks up and down the door grates, making his gnarled fingers work. "No pawns today," he said, allowing himself a sidelong glance at the box in the man's hand. "Look here." The man produced a bundle of linen from the shoebox. A dinner napkin he unwrapped to reveal 9 or 10 utensils. "Good silverware. You buy silver, I know that." "I do, yes." Satrakian, having unlocked the grate, rested the handle of his tall walking stick against his shoulder and selected a knife, weighing it, rubbing the blade with his fingers. After patting his vest pockets, he turned to Eef. "You have $10, doctor." In the interest of hurrying this along, Eef reached for his money clip and peeled off a $10 bill. He handed it to the man with the shoebox. Satrakian then handed the man back his utensils. "You take," he said. "Not real silver." The man accepted the handout gratefully and backed away with the shoebox under his arm. "God bless," Satrakian said, entering his shop. "We'll soon see about that." Eve watched his money hustle off down the street, then followed Satrakian inside. "The lights are right on the wall there," said the old man, pulling the gate ends to meet again, locking up. Nora threw all three switches at once, illuminating glass cabinets, display walls, and the entrance where they stood. It was a small corner shop, wedge-shaped, banged into the city block with a wooden hammer. The first word that came to Eve's mind was junk. Lots and lots of junk. Old stereo systems, VCRs and other outdated electronics, a wall display of musical instruments including a banjo and a guitar-like keyboard from the 1980s, religious statues and collectible plates, a couple of turntables and small mixing boards, a locked glass countertop featuring cheap brooches and high-flash, low-quality bling, racks of clothes, mostly winter coats with fur collars. So much junk that this heart fell a little. Had he entrusted this precious time to a crazy person? "Look," he told the old man, "we have a colleague. We believe he is infected." Satrakian passed him, tapping his oversized walking stick. He lifted the hinged counter with his gloved hand and invited Eve and Nora through. "We go up here." A back staircase led to a door on the second floor. The old man touched the mezuzah before entering, leaning his tall stick against the wall. It was an aged apartment of low ceilings and worn-out rugs. The furniture hadn't been moved in perhaps 30 years. "You are hungry?" Satrakian asked. "Look around. You'll find something." Satrakian lifted the top of a fancy pastry container, revealing an open box of devil dogs. He lifted one out, tearing open its cellophane wrapper. "Don't let your energy run down. Keep your strength. You'll need it." The old man bit into the cream-filled cake on his way to a bedroom to change clothes. Eve looked around the small kitchen, and then at Nora. The place smelled clean despite its cluttered appearance. Nora lifted from the table with only one chair a framed black-and-white portrait of a young, raven-haired woman in a simple dark dress, posed upon a great rock at an otherwise empty beach, fingers laced over one bare knee, pleasant features arranged in a winning smile. Eve returned to the hallway through which they had entered, looking into the old mirrors hanging from the walls, dozens of them, all of different sizes, time-streaked and imperfect. Old books were stacked along both sides of the floor, narrowing the passageway. The old man reappeared, having changed into different articles of the same sort of clothing. An old tweed suit with vest, braces, a necktie, and brown leather shoes buffed until thin. He still wore wool-tipless gloves over his damaged hands. "I see you collect mirrors," Eve said. "Certain kinds. I find older glass to be most revealing. Are you ready now to tell us what is going on?" The old man dipped his head gently to one side. "Doctor, this isn't something one simply tells. It is something that must be revealed." He moved past Eve to the door through which they had entered. "Please, come with." Eve followed him back down the stairs, Nora behind him. They passed the first floor pawn shop, continuing through another locked door to another curling flight leading down. The old man descended, one angled step at a time, his gnarled hand sliding down the cool iron rail, his voice filling the narrow passageway. "I consider myself a repository of ancient knowledge, of persons dead and books long forgotten. Knowledge accumulated over a life of study." Nora said, "When you stopped us outside the morgue, you said a number of things. You indicated that you knew the dead from the airplane were not decomposing normally."
"Correct."
"Based upon?"
"My experience."
Nora was confused. "Experience with other aircraft-related incidents?"
"The fact that they were on an airplane is completely incidental. I have seen this phenomenon before indeed. In Budapest, in Basra, in Prague, and not 10 kilometers outside Paris. I have seen it in a tiny fishing village on the banks of the Yellow River. I have seen it at 7,000 feet elevation, in the Altai Mountains of Mongolia. And yes, I have seen it on this continent as well, seen its traces, usually dismissed as a fluke, or explained away as rabies, or schizophrenia, insanity, or most recently, an occasion of serial murder."
"Hold on, hold on.
You yourself have seen corpses slow to decompose? It is the first stage, yes. Eve said, the first stage. The landing curled to an end at a locked door. Satrakian produced a key, separate from the rest, hanging from a chain around his neck. The old man's crooked fingers worked the key into two padlocks, one large, one small. The door opened inward, hot lights coming on automatically, and they followed him inside the humming basement room, bright and deep. The first thing to catch Eve's eye was a wall of battle armor, ranging from full knight's wear to chainmail to Japanese samurai torso and neck plates and kruta gear made of woven leather for protecting the neck, chest, and groin. Weapons also, mounted swords and knives, their blades fashioned of bright cold steel. More modern-looking devices were arranged at an old low table, their battery packs in chargers. He recognized night vision goggles and modified nail guns, and more mirrors, mostly pocket-sized, arranged so that he could see himself staring in bewilderment at this gallery of what? The shop, the old man gestured to the floor above them, gave me a fair living, but I did not come to this line of business because of an affinity for transistor radios and heirloom jewelry. He closed the door behind them, the lights around the door frame going dark. The installed fixtures ran the height and length of the door. Purple tubes, Eve recognized as ultraviolet lamps, arranged around the door like a force field of light. To prohibit germs from entering the room, or to keep something else out? No, he continued. The reason I chose it as my profession was because it afforded me ready access to an underground market of esoteric items, antiquities, and tomes. Illicit, though not usually illegal, acquired for my personal collection and my research. Eve looked around again. This looked less like a museum collection than a small arsenal. Your research? Indeed. I was for many years a professor of Eastern European literature and folklore at the University of Vienna. Eve appraised him again. He sure dressed like a Viennese professor. And you retired to become a Harlem pawnbroker / curator? I did not retire. I was made to leave. Disgraced. Certain forces aligned against me. And yet, as I look back now, going underground at that time most certainly saved my life. It was, in fact, the best thing I could have done. He turned to face them, folding his hands behind his back, professorially. This scourge we are now witnessing in its earliest stages has existed for centuries, over millennia. I suspect, though I cannot prove, it goes back to the most ancient of times. Eve nodded, not understanding the man, only glad to finally be making some progress. So we are talking about a virus? Yes, of sorts. A strain of disease that is a corruption of both the flesh and the spirit. The old man was positioned in such a way, from Eve's and Nora's perspective, the array of swords on the wall fanned out on either side of him like steel-bladed wings. So a virus? Yes. But I should also like to introduce you to another V word. What's that? He said. Vampire. A word like that, spoken in earnestness, hangs in the air for a while. You are thinking, said Satrakian, the former professor, of a moody overactor in a black satin cape, or else a dashing figure of power with hidden fangs, or some existential soul burdened with the curse of eternal life, or Bela Lugosi meets Abbott and Costello. Nora was looking around the room again. I don't see any crucifixes or holy water, no strings of garlic. Garlic has certain interesting immunological properties and can be useful in its own right, so its presence in the mythology is biologically understandable at any rate. But crucifixes and holy water, he shrugged. Products of their time, products of one Victorian author's fevered Irish imagination and the religious climate of the day. Satrakian had expected their expressions of doubt. They have always been here, he continued, nesting, feeding, in secret and in darkness, because that is their nature. There are seven originals known as the ancients, the masters. Not one per continent. They are not solitary beings as a rule, but clannish, Until very recently considering their open-ended lifespan, they were all spread throughout the greatest landmass, what we know today as Europe and Asia, the Russian Federation, the Arabian Peninsula, and the African continent, which is to say, the Old World. There was a schism, a clash among their kind. The nature of this disagreement, I do not know. Suffice it to say, this rift preceded the discovery of the New World by centuries. Then the founding of the American colonies opened the door to a new and fertile land. Three remained behind in the Old World, and three went ahead to the New. Both sides respected the other's domain, and a truce was agreed upon and upheld. The problem was that seventh ancient. He is a rogue who turned his back on both factions. While I cannot prove it at this time, the abrupt nature of this act leads me to believe that he is behind this.
This? Said Nora.
This incursion into the New World, breaking the solemn truce, this upsetting of the balance of their breed's existence, an act essentially of war.
Eve said, a war of vampires.
Tsitsakian's smile was for himself. You simplify because you cannot believe. You reduce, you diminish, because you were raised to doubt and debunk, to reduce to a small set of knowns for easy digestion, because you are a doctor, a man of science, and because this is America, where everything is known and understood, and God is a benevolent dictator, and the future must always be bright. He clasped his gnarled hands as best he could, touching his bare fingertips to his lips in a pensive moment. This is the spirit here, and it is beautiful. Truly, I don't mock. Wonderful to believe only in what you wish to believe in, and to discount all else. I do respect your skepticism, Dr. Goodweather, and I say this to you in the hope that you will in turn respect my experience in this matter, and allow my observations into your highly civilized and scientific mind. Eve said, so you're saying the airplane, one of them was on it, this rogue.
Exactly.
In the coffin, in the cargo hold. A coffin full of soil. They are of the earth, and like to return to that from which they arose. Like worms, vermis, they burrow to nest. We would call it sleep.
Away from daylight, said Nora.
From sunlight, yes. It is in transit that they are most vulnerable. But you said this is a war of vampires. But isn't it vampires against people? All those dead passengers? This, too, will be difficult for you to accept. But to them, we are not enemies. We are not worthy foes. We don't even rise to that level in their eyes. To them, we are prey. We are food and drink. Animals in a pen. Bottles upon a shelf.
Eve felt a chill, but then just as quickly rejected his own shivery response.
And to someone who would say this sounds like so much science fiction? Tsitsakian pointed to him. That device in your pocket, your mobile telephone. You punch in a few numbers, and immediately you are in conversation with another person halfway around the world. That is science fiction, Dr. Goodweather. Science fiction come true. Here Tsitsakian smiled. Do you require proof? Tsitsakian went to a low bench set against the long wall. There was a thing there covered in a drape of black silk, and he reached for it in an odd way, his arm outstretched, pinching the nearest edge of fabric while keeping his body as far away from it as possible, and then drawing the cover off. A glass container, a specimen jar, available from any medical supply house. Inside, suspended in a dusky fluid, was a well-preserved human heart. Eve stooped to regard it from a few feet away. Adult female, judging by the size, healthy, fairly young, fresh specimen. He looked back at Tsitsakian. Where'd you get it? I cut it out of the chest of a young widow in a village outside Shkodër in northern Albania in the spring of 1971. Eve smiled at the strangeness of the old man's tale, leaning in for a closer look at the jar. Something like a tentacle shot out of the heart, a sucker at its tip, grabbing the glass where Eve's eye was. Eve straightened fast, He froze, staring at the jar. Nora next to him said, what the hell was that? The heart began moving in the serum. It was throbbing, beating. Eve watched the flattened, mouth-like sucker head scour the glass. He looked at Nora next to him, staring at the heart. Then he looked at Satrakian, who hadn't moved, hands resting inside his pockets. Satrakian said, "It animates whenever human blood is near." Eve stared in pure disbelief. He edged closer again, this time to the right of the sucker's pale, lipless receptor. The outgrowth detached from the interior surface of the glass, then suddenly thrust itself toward him again.
"Jesus!" exclaimed Eve.
The beating organ floated in there like some meaty, mutant fish.
"It lives on without..."
There was no blood supply. He looked at the stumps of its severed veins, aorta and vena cava. Satrakian said, "It is neither alive nor dead. It is animate. Possessed, you might say, but in the literal sense. Look closely, and you will see." Eve watched the throbbing, which he found to be irregular, not like a true heartbeat at all. He saw something moving around inside it, wriggling.
"A worm?" said Nora.
Thin and pale, lip-colored, 2 or 3 inches in length, they watched it make its rounds inside the heart like a lone sentry dutifully patrolling a long abandoned base.
"A bloodworm," said Satrakian. "A capillary parasite that reproduces in the infected. I suspect, though have no proof, that it is the conduit of the virus, the actual vector."
Eve shook his head in disbelief.
"What about this sucker?"
"The virus mimics the host form, though it reinvents its vital systems in order to best sustain itself. In other words, it colonizes and adapts the host for its survival, the host being, in this case, a severed organ floating in a jar. The virus has found a way to evolve its own mechanism for receiving nourishment."
Nora said, "Nourishment?"
"The worm lives on blood, human blood."
"Blood?"
Eve squinted at the possessed heart.
"From whom?"
Satrakian pulled his left hand out of his pocket. The wrinkled tips of his fingers showed at the end of the glove. The pad of his middle finger was scarred and smooth.
"A few drops every few days is enough. It will be hungry. I have been away."
He went to the bench and lifted the lid off the jar. Eve stepped back to watch, and with the point of a little penknife from his keychain, pricked the tip of his finger over the jar. He did not flinch, the act so routine that it no longer hurt him. His blood dripped into the serum. The sucker fed on the red drops with lips like that of a hungry fish. When he was done, the old man dabbed a bit of liquid bandage on his finger from a small bottle on the bench, returning the lid to the jar. Eve watched the feeder turn red. The worm inside the organ moved more fluidly and with increased strength.
"And you say you've kept this thing going in here for..."
"Since the spring of 1971. I don't take many vacations."
He smiled at his little joke, looking at his pricked finger, rubbing the dried tip.
"She was a revenant, one who was infected, who had been turned. The ancients, who wish to remain hidden, will kill immediately after feeding, in order to prevent any spread of their virus. One got away somehow, returned home to claim its family and friends and neighbors, burrowing into their small village. This widow's heart had not been turned 4 hours before I found her."
"4 hours? How did you know?"
"I saw the mark. The mark of the Strigoi."
Eve said, "Strigoi?
Old word term for vampire."
"And the mark?"
"The point of penetration. A thin breach across the front of the throat, which I am guessing you have seen by now."
Eve and Nora were nodding, thinking about Jim.
Satrakian added, "I should say, I am not a man who is in the habit of cutting out human hearts. This was a bit of dirty business I happened upon quite by accident. But it was absolutely necessary."
Nora said, "And you've kept this thing going ever since then, feeding it like a pet?"
"Yes." He looked down at the jar almost fondly.
It serves as a daily reminder of what I am up against, what we are now up against. Eve was aghast. In all this time, why haven't you shown this to anyone? A medical school? The evening news?
Were it that easy, Doctor, the secret would have become known years ago. There are forces aligned against us. This is an ancient secret, and it reaches deep, touches many. The truth would never be allowed to reach a mass audience, but would be suppressed, and myself with it. Why I've been hiding here, hiding in plain sight, all these years, waiting.
This kind of talk raised the hair on the back of Eve's neck. The truth was right there, right in front of him, the human heart in a jar, housing a worm that thirsted for the old man's blood.
I'm not very good with secrets that imperil the future of the human race. No one else knows about this?
Oh, someone does. Yes, someone powerful. The Master. He could not have traveled unaided. A human ally must have arranged for his safeguarding and transportation. You see, vampires cannot cross bodies of flowing water unless aided by a human. A human inviting them in. And now the seal, the truce, has been broken by an alliance between Strigoi and human. That is why this incursion is so shocking and so fantastically threatening.
Nora turned to Satrakian. How much time do we have?
The old man had already run the numbers. It will take this thing less than 1 week to finish off all of Manhattan, and fewer than 3 months to overtake the country. In 6 months, the world.
No way, said Eve. Not going to happen.
I admire your determination, said Satrakian, but you still don't quite know what it is you are up against.
Okay, Eve said. Then tell me, where do we start?
Park Place, Tribeca.
Vasily Fett pulled up in his city-marked van outside an apartment building down in Lower Manhattan. It didn't look like much from the outside, but had an awning and a doorman, and this was Tribeca, after all. He would have double-checked the address were it not for the health department van parked illegally out in front, yellow dash light twirling. Ironically, in most buildings and homes in most parts of the city, exterminators were welcomed with open arms, like police arriving at the scene of a crime. Vasily didn't think that would be the case here. His own van said BPCS-CNY on the back, standing for Bureau of Pest Control Services, City of New York. The health department inspector, Bill Ferber, met him on the stairs inside. Billy had a sloping blonde mustache that rode out the face waves caused by his constant jaw of nicotine replacement gum. Vaz, he called him, which was short for Vasya, the familiar diminutive form of his given Russian name. Vaz, or simply V, as he was often called, second-generation Russian, his gruff voice all Brooklyn. He was a big man, filling most of the stairway. Billy clapped him on the arm, thanked him for coming. My cousin's niece here got bit on the mouth. I know, not my kind of building, but what can I do? They married into real estate money. Just so you know, it's family. I told them I was bringing in the best rat man in the five boroughs. Vasily nodded with the quiet pride characteristic of exterminators. An exterminator succeeds in silence. Success means leaving behind no indication of his success, no trace that a problem ever existed, that a pest had ever been present or a single trap laid. It means that order has been preserved. He pulled his wheeled case behind him like a computer repairman's toolkit. The interior of the loft opened to high ceilings and wide rooms, an 1,800-square-foot condo that cost $3 million easily in New York real estate dollars. Seated on a short, firm, basketball-orange sofa inside a high-tech room done in glass, teak, and chrome, a young girl clutched a doll and her mother. A large bandage covered the girl's upper lip and cheek. The mother wore her hair buzzed short, eyeglasses with narrow, rectangular frames, and a nubby, green, knee-length wool skirt. She looked to Vasily like a visitor from a very hip, androgynous future. The girl was young, maybe 5 or 6, and still frightened. Vasily would have attempted a smile, but this was the sort of face that rarely put children at ease.
He had a jaw like the flat back of an axe blade and widely spaced eyes. A panel television hung on the wall like a wide, glass-framed painting. On it, the mayor was speaking into a bouquet of microphones. He was trying to answer questions about the missing dead from the airplane, the bodies that had disappeared from the city's morgues. The NYPD was on high alert and actively stopping all refrigerated trucks at bridges and tunnels. A tips line had been set up. The victims' families were outraged, and funerals had been put on hold. Bill led Facili to the girl's bedroom. A canopy bed, a gem-encrusted Bratz television and matching laptop, and an animatronic butterscotch pony in the corner. Facili's eyes went immediately to a food wrapper near the bed. Toasted crackers with peanut butter inside. He liked those himself. "She was in here taking a nap," said Billy. "Woke up feeling something gnawing on her lip. The thing was up on her pillow, Vaz. A rat in her bed. Kid won't sleep for a month. You ever heard of this?" Facili shook his head. There were rats in and around every building in Manhattan, no matter what landlords say or tenants think. But they didn't like to make their presence known, especially in the middle of the day. Rat attacks generally involve children, most often around the mouth, because that's where the food smell is. Norway rats, Rattus norvegicus, city rats, have a highly defined sense of smell and taste. Their front incisors are long and sharp, stronger than aluminum, copper, lead, and iron. Knowing rats are responsible for 1/4 of all electric cable breaks in the city, and the likely culprit behind the same percentage of fires of unknown origin. Their teeth are comparable in pure hardness to steel, and the alligator-like structure of their jaw allows for thousands of pounds of biting pressure. They can chew through cement and even stone. Facili said, "Did you see the rat? She didn't know what it was. She screamed and flailed and it ran off. The emergency room told them it was a rat." Facili went to the window that was open a few inches to let in a breeze. He pushed it open farther and looked down 3 stories to a narrow cobblestone alley. The fire escape was 10 or 12 feet from the window, but the centuries-old brick facing was uneven and craggy. People think of rats as squat and waddling when in fact they move with squirrel-like agility, especially when motivated by food or by fear. Facili pulled the girl's bed away from the wall and shed its bedding. He moved a dollhouse, a bureau, and a bookcase in order to look behind them, but he did not expect to find the rat still in the bedroom. He was merely eliminating the obvious. He stepped out into the hallway, pulling his wheeled cart along the smooth, varnished wood. Rats have poor eyesight and move largely by feel. They get about quickly by repetition, wearing paths along low walls, rarely traveling more than 60 feet from their nest. They don't trust unfamiliar settings. This rat would have found the door and turned the corner, hugging the right-hand wall, his coarse fur gliding against the floorboard. The next open door led into a bathroom, the young daughter's own, decorated with a strawberry-shaped bath mat, a pale pink shower curtain, and a basket of bath bubbles and toys. Facili scanned the room for hiding places, then sniffed the air. He nodded to Billy, who then closed the door on him. Billy lingered a minute, listening, then decided to head back out to reassure the mother. He was almost there when he heard from the hallway bathroom a terrific bang, the sound of bottles falling into the bathtub, and a loud grunt and Vasily's voice, grown fierce, spurting Russian invective. The mother and daughter looked stricken. Billy held out a hand to them in a gesture of patience, having accidentally swallowed his gum, then rushed back down the hall. Facili opened the bathroom door. He was wearing Kevlar-sleeved trapping gloves and holding a large sack. Something in the sack was writhing and pawing, and that something was big. Facili nodded once and handed the sack to Billy. Billy couldn't do anything other than take it, otherwise the sack would fall and the rat would escape. He hoped the fabric was as sturdy as it seemed, the big rat twisting and fighting inside. Billy held the sack out as far from his body as his arm would reach, while still allowing him to hold the flailing rat aloft. Facili was, meanwhile, calmly, but too slowly, opening his cart. He removed a sealed package, a sponge prepared with halothane. Facili took back the sack and Billy was only too happy to relinquish it. He opened the top just long enough to drop the anesthetic inside, then closed it again. The rat struggled just as violently at first, then it began to slow down. Vasily shook the sack to speed up the process. He waited a few more moments after the fighting stopped, then opened the sack and reached inside, pulling the rat out, tail first. It was sedated, but not unconscious, its pink-digited front paws still digging their sharp nails into the air, its jaw snapping, its shiny black eyes open. This was a good-sized one, maybe 8 inches of body, the tail another 8. Its tough fur was dark gray on top, dirty white below. Nobody's escaped pet. This was a wild city rat. Billy had moved many steps back. He had seen plenty of rats in his day, yet he never got used to them. Vasily seemed to be okay with it.
"She's pregnant," he said. "Rats gestate for just 21 days and can birth a litter of up to 20 pups. One healthy female can breed 250 pups each year, with half of that litter more females ready to mate. Want me to bleed her for the lab?" Billy shook his head, showing almost as much disgust as though Vasily had asked if he wanted to eat it. "The girl had her shots at the hospital. Look at the size, Vaz. In the good name of Christ. I mean, this isn't..." Billy lowered his voice. "This isn't some tenement in Bushwick. You catch my drift?"
Vasily did catch his drift. Intimately. Vasily's parents had first settled in Bushwick after they came over. Bushwick had seen waves of émigrés since the mid-1800s. The Germans, the English, the Irish, the Russians, the Polish, the Italians, the African-Americans, the Puerto Ricans. Now it was Dominicans, Guyanese, Jamaicans, Ecuadorians, Indians, Koreans, Southeast Asians. Vasily spent a lot of time in the poorest neighborhoods of New York. He knew of families who used couch cushions, books, and furniture to wall off parts of their apartment every night, trying to keep out rats. But this attack, indeed, was different. Daylight. The boldness. Usually it is only the weakest rats, forced out of the colony, who surface in search of food. This was a strong, healthy female. Highly unusual. Rats coexist in a fragile balance with man, exploiting the vulnerabilities of civilization, living off the larger breed's waste and refuse, lurking just out of sight, behind the walls, or beneath the floorboards. The appearance of a rat symbolizes human anxiety and fear. Any incursion beyond the usual nocturnal scavenging indicates an alteration in the environment. Like man, rats are not accustomed to taking unnecessary risks. They have to be forced from the underground.
"Want me to comb it for fleas?"
"Christ, no. Just bag it and get rid of it. Whatever you do, don't show it to the girl. She's traumatized enough as it is."
Vasily pulled a large plastic bag from his kit and sealed the rat inside it with another sponge of halothane, this one a fatal dose. He stuffed the bag inside the sack to hide the evidence, then continued about his business, starting in the kitchen. He pulled out the heavy 8-burner stove and dishwasher. He checked the pipe holes under the sink. He saw no droppings, no burrows, but he seated a little bait behind the cabinets anyway, because he was there. He did so without telling the occupants. People get nervous about poison, especially parents, but the truth is that rat poison is all over every building and street in Manhattan. Anything you see that resembles berry blue pop rocks or green kibble, you know rats have been spotted nearby. Billy followed him down into the basement. It was neat and orderly, with no evident trash or soft refuse for nesting. Vasily scanned the space, sniffing for droppings. He had a good nose for rats, just as rats had a good nose for humans. He switched off the light, much to Bill's discomfort, and switched on the flashlight he wore clipped to the belt of his light blue overalls, shining purple instead of white. Rodent urine shows up indigo blue under black light, but here he saw none. He baited the crawl space with rodenticide and put down corner motel-type traps, just in case, then followed Billy back up to the lobby. Billy thanked Vasily and told him he owed him one, and they went their separate ways at the door. Vasily was still puzzled, though, and after returning his kit and the dead rat to the back of his van, lit a Dominican Corona and started walking. He went down the street and around to the cobblestone alley he had looked down upon from the girl's window. Tribeca was the sole remaining neighborhood in Manhattan with any alleys left. Vasily hadn't gone more than a few steps before he saw his first rat, skittering along the edge of a building, feeling its way around. He then saw another on a branch of a small, struggling tree grown up alongside a short brick wall, and a third squatting in the stone gutter, drinking brown effluent flowing from some unseen garbage or sewage source. As he stood there watching, rats started appearing out of the cobblestones, literally clawing up from between the worn-down stones, surfacing from the underground. Rats' skeletons are collapsible, allowing them to squeeze through holes no larger than the size of their skulls, about 3/4 inch in width. They were coming up through the gaps in twos and threes, and quickly scattering. Using the 12x3 stones as a ruler, Vasily estimated that these rats range from 8 to 10 inches in body length, doubled by their tail. In other words, fully grown adults. Two garbage bags near him were twitching and bulging, rats eating their way through their insides. A small rat tried to dart past him to a trash barrel, and Vasily kicked out with his work boot, punting the muncher back 15 feet. It landed in the middle of the alley, not moving. Within seconds, the other rats were greedily upon it, long, yellow incisors biting through fur. The most effective and efficient way to exterminate rats is to remove the food source from their environment and then let them eat one another. These rats were hungry, and they were on the run. Such daytime surface activity was practically unheard of. This kind of mass displacement only happened in the wake of an event such as an earthquake or a building collapse, or occasionally a large construction project. Vasily continued another block south, crossing Barclay Street to where the city opened up to the sky above, a 16-acre job site. He stepped up to one of the viewing platforms overlooking the location of the former World Trade Center. They were nearing completion of the deep underground basin meant to support the new construction, the cement and steel columns now starting to rise out of the ground. The site existed like a gouge in the city, like the gnaw in a little girl's face. Vasily remembered that apocalyptic September of 2001. A few days after the Twin Towers collapsed, he had gone in with the health department, starting with the shuttered restaurants around the perimeter of the site, clearing away abandoned food, then down into the basements and underground rooms, never once seeing a live rat, but plenty of evidence of their presence, including miles of rat tracks enshrined in the settled dust. He remembered most vividly a Mrs. Fields cookie shop, almost entirely eaten through. The rat population was exploding at the site, the concern being that the rats would spill out of the ruins in search of new food sources, swarming into the surrounding streets and neighborhoods. So a massive, federally funded containment program was undertaken. Thousands of bait stations and steel wire traps were set down in and around Ground Zero, and thanks to Vasily's vigilance and that of others like him, the feared invasion never did materialize. Vasily remained on a government contract to this day, his department overseeing a rat control study in and around Battery Park. So he was pretty well caught up on local infestations, and had been throughout the beginnings of the construction project. And until now, everything had been business as usual. He looked down at the trucks pouring cement and the cranes moving rubble. He waited 3 minutes for a young boy to finish with one of the mounted viewfinders, the same kind they have on top of the Empire State Building, then dropped in his 2 quarters and scanned the worksite. In a moment he saw them, their little brown bodies scuttling out from corners, racing around stone piles, a few scampering hell-bent for leather up the access road toward Liberty Street, racing around rebar spikes, marking the foundation of the Freedom Tower as though running a goddamn obstacle course. He looked for the breaks where the new construction would connect underground with the PATH subway. Then he turned the viewfinder higher and followed a line of them, scrambling up the underpinnings of a steel platform along the east corner, clambering out onto strung wires. They were racing out of the basin, a mass exodus, following any escape route they could find. Isolation Ward, Jamaica Hospital Medical Center, Queens. Behind the second door of the isolation ward, Eve pulled on latex gloves. He would have insisted that Satrakian do the same, but another look at his crooked fingers made Eve wonder if it would even be possible. They walked inside Jim Kent's bay, the only occupied station in the otherwise empty ward. Jim lay sleeping now, still in his street clothes, wires from his chest and hand leading to machines whose readings were quiet. The attending nurse had said his levels were dipping so low that all the automatic alarms, low heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, oxygen levels, had to be muted because they kept going off. Eve pushed past the hanging curtains of clear plastic, feeling Satrakian grow tense beside him. As they got close, Kent's vitals rose on all the readout screens, which was highly irregular.
"Like the worm in the jar," said Satrakian. "He senses us. He senses that blood is near."
"Can't be," said Eve.
He advanced farther. Jim's vitals and brainwave activity increased.
"Jim," said Eve.
His face was slack in sleep, his dark skin turning a putty gray color. Eve could see his pupils moving fast beneath his eyelids in a kind of manic REM sleep. Satrakian drew back the last intervening layer of clear curtain with the silver wolf's head of his tall walking staff.
"Not too close," he warned.
"He is turning." Satrakian reached into his coat pocket.
"Your mirror. Take it out."
The inside front pocket of Eve's jacket was weighed down by a 4-inch by 3-inch silver-framed mirror, one of the many items the old man had collected from his basement vampire armory.
"You see yourself in there?"
Eve saw his reflection in the old glass.
"Sure."
"Please use it to look at me." Eve turned it at an angle so as to view the old man's face.
"Okay."
Nora said, "Vampires have no reflection." Satrakian said,
"Not quite. Please now, with caution, use it to look at his face."
Because the mirror was so small, Eve needed to step closer to the bed, his arm outstretched, holding the glass at an angle over Jim's head. He couldn't pick up Jim's reflection at first. The image looked as though Eve's hand were violently shaking, but the background, the pillow and bed frame, were still. Jim's face was a blur. It looked as though his head was shaking with tremendous speed, or vibrating with such force that his features were imperceptible. He pulled his arm back fast.
"Silver backing," said Satrakian, tapping his own mirror. "That is the key. Today's mass-produced mirrors, with their chrome-sprayed backing, they won't reveal anything. But silver-backed glass always tells the truth."
Eve looked at himself in the mirror again, normal, except for the slight trembling of his own hand. He angled the glass over Jim Kent's face again, trying to hold it still, and saw the tremulous blur that was Jim's reflection, as though his body were in the throes of something furious, his being vibrating too hard and too fast to be visibly rendered. Yet to the naked eye he lay still and serene. Eve handed it to Nora, who shared his astonishment and his fear.
"So this means he's turning into a thing like Captain Redfern."
Satrakian said, "Following normal infection, they can complete their transformation and activate to feeding after just one day and night. It takes 7 nights for one to fully turn, for the disease to consume the body and reshape it to its own end, its new parasitic state. Then about 30 nights to total maturity."
Nora said, "Total maturity?"
The old man said, "Pray we don't see that phase." He gestured toward Jim. "The arteries of the human neck offer the quickest access point, though the femoral artery is another direct route into our blood supply." The neck breach was so neat it was not visible at the moment. Eve said,
"Why blood?"
"Oxygen, iron, and many other nutrients."
"Oxygen?" asked Nora.
Satrakian nodded. "Their host bodies change. Part of the turning is that the circulatory and digestive systems merge, becoming one, similar to insects. Their own blood substance lacks the iron and oxygen combination that accounts for the red color of human blood. Their product turns white."
"And the organs?" Eve said.
"Red ferns looked almost like cancers." "The body system is being consumed and transformed. The virus takes over. They no longer breathe.
They respire, merely as a vestigial reflex. But they don't oxygenate anymore. The unneeded lungs eventually shrivel and are readapted. Eve said, Redfern, when he attacked, exhibited a highly developed growth in his mouth, like a well-developed muscular stinger underneath the tongue. Satrakian nodded, as though agreeing with Eve about the weather. It engorges as they feed. Their flesh flushes almost crimson, their eyeballs, their cuticles. This stinger, as you call it, is in fact a reconversion, a repurposing of the old pharynx, trachea, and lung sacs with the newly developed flesh. Something like the sleeve of a jacket being reversed. The vampire can expel this organ from its own chest cavity, shooting out well over 4 and up to even 6 feet. If you anatomize a mature victim, you would find a muscular tissue, a sac, that propels this for feeding. All they require is the regular ingestion of pure human blood. They are maybe like diabetics in that way. I don't know. You are the doctor.
I thought I was, mumbled Eef, until now.
Nora said, I thought vampires drank virgin blood. They hypnotize. They turn into bats.
Satrakian said, they are much romanticized. But the truth is more, how should I say, perverse, said Eef.
Disgusting, said Nora.
No, said Satrakian.
Banal. Do you find the ammonia?
Eef nodded.
They have a very compact digestive system, Satrakian continued. No room for storing the food. Any undigested plasma and any other residues have to be expelled to make room for incoming nourishment, much like a tick, excreting as it feeds. Suddenly the temperature inside the bay changed. Satrakian's voice dropped to an icy whisper.
Strigoi, he hissed. Here.
Eef looked at Jim. Jim's eyes were open, his pupils dark, the sclera around them turning grayish-orange, almost like an uncertain sky at dusk. He was staring at the ceiling. Eef felt a spike of fear. Satrakian stiffened, his gnarled hand poised near the wolf's head handle of his walking stick, ready to strike. Eef felt the electricity of his intent and was shocked by the deep, ancient hatred he saw in the old man's eyes.
Professor,
said Jim on a slight groan escaping from his lips. Then his eyelids fell closed again, Jim lapsing back into a REM-like trance. Eef turned to the old man.
How did he know you?
He doesn't, said Satrakian, still on alert, poised to strike. He is like a drone now, becoming a part of a hive. A body of many parts, but one single will. He looked at Eef. This thing must be destroyed.
What?
Said Eef.
No.
He is no longer your friend, said Satrakian. He is your enemy.
Even if that is true, he is still my patient.
This man is not ill. He has moved into a realm beyond illness. In a matter of hours, no part of him will remain. Apart from all that, it is supremely dangerous keeping him here. As with the pilot, you will be placing the people in this building at great risk.
What if he doesn't get blood?
Without nourishment, he will begin caving. After 48 hours without feeding, his body will begin to fail, his system cannibalizing his body's human muscle and fat cells, slowly and painfully consuming itself, until only the vampiric systems prevail. Eef was shaking his head hard. What I need to do is formulate some protocol for treatment. If this disease is caused by a virus, I need to work toward finding a cure. Satrakian said, there is only one cure. Death. Destruction of the body. A merciful death. Eef said, we're not veterinarians here. We can't just put down people who are too ill to survive. You did so with the pilot. Eef stuttered. That was different. He attacked Nora and Jim. He attacked me. Your philosophy of self-defense, if truly applied, absolutely holds in this situation. So would a philosophy of genocide. And if that is their goal, total subjugation of the human race, what is your answer? Eef didn't want to get tangled up in abstractions here. He was looking at a colleague, a friend. Satrakian saw that he was not going to change their minds here, Not just yet. Take me to the pilot's remains, then. Perhaps I can convince you. No one spoke on the elevator ride down to the basement. There, instead of finding the locked morgue room, they found the door open and the police and the hospital administrator huddling around it. Eve went up to them. What do you think you're doing? He saw that the door jamb was scratched, the metal door frame dented and jimmied, the lock broken from the outside. The administrator hadn't opened the door. Someone else had broken in. Eve quickly looked inside. The table was bare. Redfern's body was gone. Eve turned to the administrator, wanting more information, but to his surprise found her retreating a few steps down the hall, glancing back at him as she spoke with the cops. Satrakian said, "We should go now." Eve said, "But I have to find out where his remains are." "They are gone," said Satrakian. "They will never be recovered." The old man gripped Eve's arm with surprising strength. "I believe they have served their purpose."
"Their purpose? What is that?"
"Distraction, ultimately. For they are no more dead than their fellow passengers who once lay in the morgues."
Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn.
Newly widowed Glory Mueller was searching online about what to do when a spouse dies without leaving a will, noticed a news report about the missing corpses from Flight 753. She followed the link, reading a dispatch labeled "Developing." The Federal Bureau of Investigation was due to hold a press conference within the hour, it said, to announce a new and larger reward for any information about the disappearance from the morgue of the bodies of the victims of the Regis Air tragedy. This story struck a deep note of fear. For some reason, she now remembered that previous night, awakening from a dream and hearing sounds in her attic. Of the dream that had awakened her, she remembered only that Herman, her newly deceased husband, had come back to her from the dead. There had been a mistake, and the strange tragedy that was Flight 753 had never actually occurred, and Herman had arrived at the back door of their home in Sheepshead Bay with a you-thought-you-were-rid-of-me smile, wanting his supper. In public, Glory had played the part of a quietly grieving widow, as she would continue to do so throughout whatever inquest and court cases might come her way. But she was perhaps alone in considering the tragic circumstances that claimed the life of her husband of 13 years a great gift. 13 years of marriage. 13 years of unrelenting abuse. Escalating throughout their years together, occurring more and more in front of their boys, ages 9 and 11. Glory lived in constant fear of his mood swings, and had even allowed herself, a daydream only, too risky to attempt in reality, to consider what it would be like to pack up the boys and leave while he was away this past week, visiting his dying mother in Heidelberg. But where could she go? And more important, what would he do to her and the boys if he caught up with them, as she knew he would? But God was good. He had finally answered her prayers. She and her boys had been delivered. This dark pall of violence had been lifted from their home. She went to the bottom of the stairs, looking up to the second floor and the trap door in the ceiling there, its rope pull hanging down. The raccoons. They were back. Herman, he'd first trapped one in the attic. He'd taken the fear-crazed intruder out into the backyard and made an example of it in front of her boys. No more. She had nothing to be afraid of now. The boys wouldn't be home for at least another hour, and she decided to go up there now. She had planned to start going through Herman's things anyway. Trash day was Tuesday, and she wanted to have it all gone by then. She needed a weapon, and the first one that came to mind was Herman's own machete. He had brought it home some years ago and kept it wrapped in oilcloth in the locked plastic tool shed against the side of the house. When she asked him why he would ever want such a thing, a jungle tool here in Sheepshead Bay of all places, he just sneered at her. You never know. These constant little insinuated threats were part of his daily menacing. She pulled the key from the hook behind the pantry door and went outside and sprang the lock. She found the oilcloth buried under yard tools and an old splintered croquet set they had received as a wedding gift, which she would use for kindling now. She took the package into the kitchen and set it on the table, pausing before she unwrapped it. She had always ascribed evil to this object.
had always imagined it would be somehow significant in the fate of this household, possibly as an instrument of Glory's own demise at Herman's hands. Accordingly, she unwrapped it with great care, as though unswaddling a sleeping baby demon. Herman had never liked her touching his special things. The blade was long, wide, and flat. The grip was formed of wrapped leather straps, worn to a soft brown by the hand of the former owner. She lifted it, turning it over, feeling the weight of this strange object in her hand. She caught sight of her reflection in the microwave door, and it scared her. A woman standing with a machete in her kitchen. He had made her crazy. She walked upstairs with it in her hand. She stopped beneath the ceiling door and reached for the bottom knot of the dangling white rope handle. It opened down to a 45-degree angle on groaning springs. That noise should have scared any lurking critters. She listened for scattering sounds, but there were none. She reached for the high wall switch, but no light came on above. She flicked it a couple of times, but still, nothing. She hadn't been up here since after Christmas, and the bulb could have burned out at any time between now and then. There was a small skylight cut into the rafters. That would provide enough light. She unfolded the hinged stairs and started up. Three steps brought her eyeline above the attic floor. It was unfinished, with foil-backed pink fiberglass insulating blankets unrolled between the exposed joists. Plywood was laid out north-south and east-west in a cross pattern, creating a walking path to each of the four quadrants of storage space. The space was darker than she had expected, and then she saw that two of her old clothes racks had been moved, effectively blocking the low skylight. Clothes from her life before Herman, zipped up in plastic and left in storage for 13 years. She followed the plywood and moved the racks to allow more light in, with the idea of maybe sorting through the clothes and revisiting her old self. But then she saw, beyond the plywood walkway, a bare lane of floor between the two long joists, where the insulation had, for some reason, been pulled up. Then she noticed another bare lane, and another. She froze there. She sensed something at her back suddenly. She was afraid to turn, but then she remembered the machete in her hand. Behind her, against the vertical edge of the attic, farthest from the skylight, the missing strips of insulation had been piled up in a lumpy mound. Some of the fiberglass had been shredded, as though by an animal feathering an enormous nest. Not a raccoon, something bigger, much bigger. The mound was completely still, arranged as though to hide something. Had Herman been tending to some strange project without her knowing? What dark secret had he stored under here? With the machete raised in her right hand, she pulled on the end of a strip, drawing it away from the mound in a long trail that revealed nothing. She dragged away a second strip then, stopping when it revealed a man's hairy arm. Glory knew that arm. She also knew the hand it was connected to, knew them both intimately. She could not believe what she was seeing. With the machete raised in front of her, she pulled away another length of insulation. His shirt, one of the short-sleeved button-ups he favored, even in winter. Herman was a vain man, proud of his hairy arms. His wristwatch and wedding ring were gone. Glory stood riveted by the sight, melting with dread. Still, she had to see. She reached for another strip which, when drawn away, made most of the rest of the insulation slide off to the floor. Her dead husband, Herman, lay asleep in her attic, on a bed of shredded pink fiberglass, fully dressed except for his feet, which were filthy, as though from walking. She could not process this shock. She could not deal with it. The husband she had thought she was rid of, the tyrant, the batterer, the rapist. She stood over his sleeping body, the machete a sword of Damocles, ready to fall if he offered the slightest move. Then, by degrees, she lowered her arm, the machete blade coming to rest at her side. He was a ghost now, she realized. A man returned from the dead, a presence, meaning to haunt her forever. She would never be free of him. As she was thinking this, Herman opened his eyes. The lids rose on his eyeballs, staring straight up. Glory froze. She wanted to run, and she wanted to scream, and she could do neither. Herman's head rotated until his staring eyes fixed on her. That same taunting look, as always. That sneer. The look that always preceded the bad things. And then something clicked inside her head. At that same moment, four houses down the street, 3-year-old Lucy Needham stood in her driveway, feeding a doll named Baby Deer from a snack-sized bag of Cheez-Its. Lucy stopped munching the loud crackers and instead listened to the muffled screams and hard chopping thwacks coming from somewhere nearby. She looked up at her own house, then north, her nose scrunched up toward her eyes in innocent confusion. She stood very still, an orange tongue of half-chewed cheese-baked crackers sticking out of her open mouth, listening to some of the strangest noises she had ever heard. She was going to tell Daddy when he came back outside with the telephone, but by then her bag of Cheez-Its had spilled and she was squatting and eating them off the driveway, and after getting yelled at, she forgot the whole thing. Glory stood there, gasping in her attic, retching, the machete gripped in both hands. Herman lay in pieces among the sticky pink insulation, the attic wall splattered in dripping white. White. Glory trembled, soul sick. She surveyed the damage she had done. Twice, the blade had become lodged in the wood joist, and in her mind it was Herman trying to wrench the machete away from her, and she'd had to rock it back and forth violently to get it free again and keep swinging at his flesh. She backed away one step. She was experiencing an out-of-body sensation. It was shocking what she had done. Herman's sneering head had rolled off between two joists, face down now. A fluffy pinch of pink fiberglass stuck to his cheek like cotton candy. His torso was gouged and gored, his thighs sliced to the femur, his groin bubbling up white. White. She felt something poking her slipper, tap, tap, tap. She saw blood there, red blood, and realized she had nicked herself somehow, her left arm, though she felt no pain. She raised it for inspection, dripping fat red plops onto the plywood. White. She saw something dark and small slithering. She was bleary-eyed and blinking, still in the grip of a homicidal rage. She couldn't trust her sight. She felt an itch on her ankle, underneath her bloody slipper. The itch crawled up her leg, and she swatted at her thigh with the flat side of the sticky white blade. Then another tickle on the front of her other leg, and, separately, her waist. She realized she was having some sort of hysterical reaction, as if bugs were attacking her. She stumbled back another step and almost tumbled off the plywood walkway. There was then a most unnerving wriggling sensation around her crotch, and then a sudden twisting discomfort in her rectum, an intrusive slithering that made her jump and clench her buttocks as though she were about to soil herself